Hello, and welcome to episode 54 of the Story Hack Podcast. The Story Hack Podcast features action, adventure, and mystery stories, mostly from the public domain. Story Hack is also a print magazine which publishes new action and adventure stories in a wide variety of genres. Visit storyhack.com today for more information. Today will be part 5 in a series, Reading the Prince of Mars Returns by Philip Francis Nolan.
Chapter 14. We reach Gacarlu. We were allowed no time to rest. Our arms were freed, but then we were tied to the saddles of fresh dogs. Away we went at breakneck speed, over the causeway and up the road toward the sea. The Ildin who raced at our sides kept strict military order and maintained a wary watch. But at length the Epps, a handsome though evil-faced young fellow, drew up beside us and ordered the others to follow. He glanced at me with arrogant curiosity, and then at Lilrin, whose scanty desert garb concealed but little of her youthful curves. The expression in his eyes was not good to see, and so he drawled at length, "Danenle, the god from the green star, comes to Gacarlu. Is your name really Danenle?" "It is Dan Handley," I replied. He scowled. "It sounds much the same. And did you really come from the green star? What do you think?" I snapped, and at this he laughed mockingly. "It is a good story, anyhow," he said, "and one that the people love to swallow. With what, pray, did you darken your hair?" "That is its natural color," Lilrin cut in. The Epps turned to gaze appraisingly at her again with that expression that made my blood boil. "Do that again," I gritted, "and I'll find the strength to break these bonds and tear you apart." He glanced at me in pretended surprise, as though he did not understand, but underneath was that air of arrogant mockery. "I'll make a bargain with you, Danenle," he said after a bit. "Gacko knows of your coming, but not of the girls. These men are mine. Their loyalty to me is above even their loyalty to Gacko. Turn the girl over to me, and say nothing to Gacko about her. After I have delivered you at the council hall and am no longer technically responsible for you, I will contrive your escape. For Gacko surely intends to have your life," he added smugly to give weight to his evil argument. "The lesser lord's eagerness to double-cross Gacko, his commander-in-chief, is not to be wondered at. Throughout history, tyrants like Gacko, who depend on unscrupulous underlings to maintain their power, have been stabbed in the back when they least expected. Indeed, from this history-proven fact may come the original thought behind the saying that they who live by the sword shall die by the sword." I saw Lilrin stiffen in her saddle and turn scarlet. The Epps, misinterpreting my own silence, went on in the conceit that his proposal would be received as reasonable. "The girl appeals to my fancy. To have a warrior lass of the Tar Ennor among my wives would be most interesting and undoubtedly amusing." He never finished that sentence. Although my legs were tied under the dog saddle, my arms were free. At that moment his mount brought him within reach. I swayed toward the lesser lord and grasped his collar with one hand. With a wrench, I jerked him clear of his mount and planted a crushing blow in his face with my other fist. "Now, Lilrin, now!" I yelled. "Make a break for it, straight ahead." But the attempt was useless. The dogs on which we were mounted would not obey us, and in a moment we were borne helplessly to the ground by the avalanche of Ildin who leaped at us from behind. When the pile was unscrambled, I still held on to the Epps, choking and gasping from the twisting of his collar. I managed to drive my fist once more into his face before his minions pried me loose, and my dog scrambled to his feet. The lesser lord stood there spluttering and cursing, wiping the blood from his face. After a flood of invectives, he thrust his battered features forward into mine, for his men were holding me so that I could hardly move. His voice rasped with bitter malevolence. "Were it not for Gacko, I would, and by the Seven Alaran, I believe I will in spite of him. When he does see you, I can tell him you were hurt in resisting capture." And I interrupted him sharply, "I shall tell Gacko of your treason to him. Perhaps Gacko knows enough of your reputation even now to credit the infamous proposal you just made." He grew suddenly pale, in strange contrast to the blood on his face. His manner changed just as abruptly. "Enough," he said. "It was my mistake. I did not understand your viewpoint, or I should not have asked you to do anything, Doctor, dishonorable in your own eyes. But I will offer you another bargain. Ah, so I had won the upper hand, prisoner and all. Say nothing of this to Gacko, and I will agree that you and the girl shall have every possible courtesy and comfort as long as you are in my hands. Is it agreed? He demanded anxiously. Agreed, I said, and at this, the fear went out of his eyes, though there was much of worry left in his expression. Enough worry, I thought, to make him keep his promise. Or was it? Through all this, the Ilden had sat with wooden faces, though once or twice I caught the suspicion of a fleeting smile here and there among them. The Epp's followers may have been loyal, but evidently they were not personally displeased at his discomfiture. Lilrin, too, was smiling a bit, but pretending she had noticed nothing. So we went on, by easier stages now. Nor were our legs bound so tightly, and frequently the Epps had water offered to us and several times food. Once we stopped for a rest, which was most welcome. But I knew that every time my back was to him, the lesser lord's eyes were boring into me with baffled hatred. Finally, we reached our destination. Ikal looked more like a great park or flower garden than the teeming city it was. For miles in every direction the gardens lay, diamond-patterned, between diagonal rows of streets paved in dull red, but with scarcely a building above ground. That is, if the little ornate structures constituting the entrances to the underground city were accepted. Just below ground, another system of streets was laid out in squares at an angle of 45 degrees to the paths above. The main arteries of this underground system emerged at strategic traffic points beyond the city. The ground level, in other words, was in reality the roof of the city. The gardens, each surrounded by a low wall made from fragments of the iridescent stone, were places of recreation, rest, and amusement. Here an open-air cafe, with tables of intricate golden metal or carved stone, where refreshments were being served among gorgeous varicolored blooms, there, a recreation center, with crowds watching some game or performance. Gacko's palace, castle, or council hall, whatever one chose to call it, for it served all three purposes, was an edifice of such transcendent beauty as I had never seen before. In general lines it resembled somewhat the modified pyramidal motif that became so general on Earth in the second quarter of the 20th century. The structure stood at the very edge of the polar sea. In fact, abortive little waves of that windless expanse of water lapped and broke against one face of it and reached halfway down the two sides. As we approached down one of the diagonal streets, my heart leaped with satisfaction. There before us lay, anchored, the Ilman fleet, our allies, about 200 yards offshore, great raft-like, flat-bottomed craft on which huge spring-guns were mounted. Every few moments one of these would hurl a half-ton of rock at the castle, which would shatter quite futilely against the iridescent monolith, leaving its surface, as far as I could see, unmarred. I cursed silently under my breath. It was quite obvious that the Ilman attack was nothing but a gesture. Gacko had more men than the Ilman could possibly crowd on their ships. Besides, the ruler of Gacarlu had the advantage of mobility. No matter what spot the Ilman fleet might select for a landing, the defenders would concentrate a superior force there before the maneuver could be made effective. So Lilrin and I had no hope of rescue from the ships. Chapter 15. Condemned by Gacko. Immediately on our arrival, we were hustled through the triangular gate in the base of the castle on into a tunnel of the same shape, the walls coming together at an angle above to form the room. The passage inclined upward, curving about until it emerged between bastion walls of the castle proper on top of the base. Our party was halted here by a shrill order from the commander of a unit of several sturdy young Amazons of Gacko's personal guard. With some little military ceremony and a malevolent glance at me, the Epps handed us over to the girl guard, and with his followers turned back down the ramp. We were immediately seized and shackled. Noting the fetters that were in readiness, Lilrin threw me a meaning glance. I knew what she meant. This was but another evidence that our arrival was expected. The girl in command surveyed us with interest, but gave me most of her attention. Evidently, with my greater height and more muscular build than the average Martian, I was more of a novelty even than a girl warrior of the Tauren Nur. These young Amazons were clad in armor and little else. Each wore upper and forearm guards on the right arm with a large round shield protecting the left. A curiously fashioned corselet or short cuirass held up by broad straps protected the shoulders. Underneath was a broad girdle of heavy leather and metal plates, from which hung thigh guards and a kind of braconnier, a kilt of chain mail. Shin guards and sandals completed the equipment, except for the short, curved, heavy-bladed swords they carried. "Come," commanded their leader shortly. She led the way briskly through a smaller, triangular gate into the castle, and there was much resonant clashing of metal in the guards' armor as we followed. Lilrin spoke in low tones to the girl who marched beside her. I didn't know there were any girl warriors in the northern cities. I thought that only we of the Tauren'ur and the other clans of the Desert Ring. We are the war wives of Gakko, the girl explained shortly. How many wives has he? I broke in. The women, God bless em. Ask them for a little confidential information, and they'll spill the beans every time. 31, she replied, her whole manner becoming more friendly. That is, 31 war wives. The rest don't matter. They are merely slaves, playthings. We rank as Epson and have all the privileges of men. Then, after a pause, most of us war wives are from the clan south of Gakal, on the other side of the desert ring from the Tauren'ur. Gakko will probably make you one of us. Lilrin bent her head quickly to mine. He will not. She whispered tensely. You're telling me? I whispered back, reassuringly. Are you really Danenly? The girl on the other side of us now asked me. I am Dan Hanley, I replied. Sorry to have to meet you under such, doctor, disadvantageous circumstances. When I want to turn on the charm, it really gushes. Warrior or no warrior, the girl was pleased. Yes, that is what they call you, Danenly. And there are lots, too, who believe in you and think Gakko should not oppose your becoming a Laureler. And she gave me a look that meant plenty. Further conversation, however, was interrupted by a curt command from the leader as we approached a grill. Through this we could glimpse a great hall decorated with luxurious and colorful hangings, magnificent carvings and statuary, and a riot of immense, brilliant Martian flowers. There came to us the murmur of many voices, with the occasional shouts of men and the shrieks of women drunk with lilquak. We were motioned to stay where we were. The girl in command approached a section of the grill and pressed on it with her hand. A cleverly concealed little triangular gate opened. She went in, leaving it ajar. Through this opening we caught a better view of the great tables, of the men and women lounging or sprawling about on the benches and couches. The girl beside me sniffed contemptuously. It's like this every day since Gakko first hinted at his plan to be a Laureler, she said. Lilrin looked at her sharply and then nudged me. I managed to get an annoying wink in reply. In a moment the leader of our captors returned, followed by an impressive figure of a man. The girl leader of the guard waved her hand toward us imperiously. Here they are, Gakko. They were just brought in. Gakko, though neither as tall nor as heavy as I, was nonetheless a commanding individual among Martians. He was possessed of somewhat more than their normal height and breadth of shoulder. I judged him to be a man of about 40. His face, though showing the signs of his dissipated, licentious life, nevertheless indicated both intellect and strength of will. He folded his arms casually and surveyed us with a kind of detached interest. So this, he mused, is the famous Danenly who threatens the peace and security of a whole world because of a silly ancient tradition. I started to make a reply, but the girl leader shrieked a sudden command to be silent in the presence of the Allah and struck me sharply on the mouth. So I had to keep silent, especially since Gakko, for all his assumed carelessness of manner, took care to keep several of the girls between himself and us. But for an instant, I was on the point of whipping out my concealed automatic and ending the matter then and there. Gakko continued to gaze cynically at me as his glance swept me insolently from head to foot. For an instant, a gleam lightened the lazy arrogance of his eyes. Presently, he permitted himself to pronounce upon my fate. The man is to be placed in a cell just as he is, with food to eat and water to drink, but give him no other clothing, and do not let him bathe. Suddenly conscious of my somewhat tattered garb, with the desert's red grime still upon me, I glanced down, puzzled as to the meaning of this strange order. For the life of me, I couldn't tell what he was driving at. Then, for the first time, Gacko turned and gazed directly at Lil Rin. "Ah!" he exclaimed, an expression of evil anticipation breaking over his face. "Another recruit, eh, girls?" He laughed carelessly at the unfriendly glances the jealous young war wives threw at Lil Rin. "Let her have every comfort," Gacko commanded, "and bring her to me in the morning at the council in bridal garb, for I shall wed her, and then, but we shall see about that later. And, oh yes, bring the man to me at the same time." And turning casually, he sauntered back through the grill, which closed with a little click behind him. There was an agony of pleading in Lil Rin's eyes as she turned to me. The young warrior girl seemed puzzled and uncertain. They glanced at Lil Rin uneasily. Clearly they saw in her a rival for Gacko's favors, and probably a successful one at that. They were at once jealous and fearful of her possible future position. As the girl guards marched us along another corridor, Lil Rin spoke in low tones to the leader. The girl shook her head in emphatic refusal at first, but Lil Rin pleaded, and at last the leader relented. The party halted. Half of the girls dropped back a little distance at their leader's command, and the rest went on a few paces, leaving Lil Rin and me alone together. Lil Rin stood very close to me. I asked her for just a moment to say farewell. "This is the end, Danan Le. Do you realize it?" There were tears in the green-blue eyes that looked up at me so forlornly from a white, drawn little face. Paralyzed by a sudden rush of feeling, I stood motionless, half-dazed, in the first true realization of my very real love for this girl. Chapter 16. The Crash of Doom. Lil Rin must have misunderstood my silence, for she dropped her gaze and went on in a pathetically breathless way. "Oh, I understand, Danenle, that I have been just an accident to you, that it was just the fulfillment of the ancient legend. But that isn't what I wanted to say, Danenle. I mean, Gacko has condemned you to death, or he will in the morning. And I, who am your lawful bride, even if only in name, must die too, if you do. But before I wed a northern beast like Gacko, here, Danenle, take this gun. They'd only take it away from me anyhow when they dress me in the bridal garments. Please, so carefully, I transferred the automatic to my own person." Lil Rin could say no more at the moment, for by then I had folded her in my arms, clasping her supple young form close to mine in the glorious realization at last of what she meant to me. "I love you, Lil Rin, I love you," I whispered fiercely. She relaxed against me like one exhausted, and the tears were now streaming from beneath her lowered lids. "Now I shall die happy," she murmured. "Now I shall have no regrets." "We're not going to die now," I replied. I glanced at the warrior girl standing attentively along the corridor. They were regarding us with unconcealed curiosity, but seemed in no hurry to end our rather desperate communion. "Tell me quickly, dear," I whispered, "how many of Gecko's people do you think believe in the legend?" "Oh, perhaps the great majority," she said, without any great interest in the subject, but with a wondrous look in her eyes as she gazed up from where her head nestled against my shoulder. "Then my plan may work, for I believe I know now why Gacko gave me that strange order that I was to be brought before him in council tomorrow just as I am now, dirty and disheveled." Quickly I outlined the plan for her. As I talked, the glow of hope and exuberance came back again into her eyes. "Good," Lil Rin exclaimed when I had finished. "And even if it does not work, my Danenle, we shall meet death side by side, fighting to the last." She drew herself up proudly and motioned to the leader of the girl warriors. "We are ready," she said. "So, with many curious glances and whispered comments, for obviously the girl guards were puzzled by the sudden change in our bearing, perhaps even awed a bit at the jubilant manner in which I was going forth to meet a certain death. They conducted us to the next turn in the corridor. Here, after a hasty embrace, Lil Rin and I were parted. They took me to a cell in the tower, about halfway up, from which I had a good view of the westward side of the city and the shore. After bringing me food and a little water, they left me to my meditations and plans for the morrow. First, I carefully inspected the two automatics, as soon as I was sure I was not under observation. I spent some time in practicing, until I could draw those guns from their concealed holsters with my old-time skill. Then, detail by detail, endeavoring to prepare for every possible contingency, I went over my plans again and again, until last I dropped off to sleep. In the morning, four of the warrior girls came to conduct me to the council hall. They led me to a grill door, and while I awaited the signal that would bring me before Gacko, I had plenty of time to study the great room and the throng within it. Gacko was giving the crowd a harangue that would have been a credit to an earthly politician. A master of dramatic art, he was cleverly painting a picture of himself as the popular leader, while holding his cohorts in suspense as to some great revelation he was about to make. He contrived to put across the impression that this matter would be one of great amusement to them, as well as to himself. And now, he shouted, "Behold the fair barbarian of the desert allies, Erlilrin of the Tower Ennir. Is she fair enough, I ask you, to be the bride of an Alarlur?" And he put into this last phrase a subtle suggestion. My heart pounded as I saw Lilrin step forth with stately grace. Two of Gacko's warrior girls, weapons drawn, were at her side, and two more behind. Gacko, with dramatic dignity, stepped back a pace as with a sweeping gesture he centered the attention of the throng upon her. There was a sibilant intake of breath all through the hall as Lilrin stepped forward, a murmur of surprise, and then a roar of approval. Her costume was so gorgeous, I could not have blamed the war wives for any pangs of jealousy. Unnoticed for the moment by the crowd, Gacko glanced at the door. Hastily, my guards swung it open. Before I had time to guess their purpose, they seized me roughly. Pulling and jerking me this way and that, they hustled me out on the platform in such a way as to make it appear that I was cravenly resisting and had to be dragged along. From my appearance in such grimy and tattered garments, and from the manner in which the warrior girls were roughing me, I must truly have presented a ridiculous contrast to Lilrin. A roar of laughter echoed through the great hall. Now Gacko was shouting, "Can this be the great Danenli of the legend, the hero of the green star, the Alarlur of Mars?" "No, no," roared the crowd between gusts of laughter. "I leave a decision to you, my people," Gacko shouted, holding up his hand for silence. "Shall this fair barbarian be the bride of Gacko Alarlur, or of this false hero of the legend who now cringes at my feet?" Gacko pointed dramatically at the spot where he expected me to be, for with this last speech of his as their cue, the girls who were guarding me began again to jerk me this way and that. I sensed their purpose was to trip and hurl me headlong to the floor before him. Well, I would have to disappoint them. In fact, what with my earth, strength, and all, that was precisely what I did. To their utter astonishment, it was the four of them, and not I, who went sprawling when they attempted to hurl me at Gacko's feet. In a single bound I covered the space that separated me from Gacko. When I felt the floor under my feet again, I lashed out with all the momentum of my leap and every ounce of strength in my body. There was a sharp crack as my fist landed on Gacko's jaw. The blow literally lifted him from his feet and hurled him headlong from the platform and down the steps, where he lay an inert and lifeless mass among his own lesser lords. For a moment, breathless silence pervaded the hall. Not a Martian moved. Slowly, ominously, I stepped forward to the edge of the platform facing Gacko's minions, a gun in each hand. Chapter 17. Alarlur of Mars. Proudly, calmly, as though on parade, Lilrin stepped to my side and stood quietly alert. A murmur arose in the back of the hall. There was the clang of a spring gun and the thud of its bolt somewhere behind me, but I had caught a glimpse of the gun and I fired. The roar of the automatic stunned the Martians, and there was silence again as the faint fumes of gunpowder floated hazily about me. Then the renter in the back of the hall, who had my bullet in his arm, began to shriek, and pandemonium broke loose. The Ilingaco's freemen were milling about and struggling among themselves. Half of them were panic-stricken, fighting to get out of the room. The others fought because they were attacked, or because of they knew not what. It was in the pit of the Epsom, just beneath our feet, that our danger lay, and in the warrior girls who had been guarding Lil Rin and me. I was conscious that several of the latter were now circling in behind us on the platform. Diversion came just in time to save me the necessity of turning to face the warrior wives. Several of the Epsom made a rush at us up the steps. Raising both guns, I hurled fire and lead at them. One after another, they threw up their arms and tumbled backward or plunged sprawling on their faces. Behind me, I heard the warrior girls squealing in fright and scrambling down the steps. Thunder! Lightning! One of them screamed. It is Danin Le, in truth, according to the legend. I glowered at the crowd. Wherever my glance fell, men shrank back, fear and wonder upon their faces. I stepped forward a pace then and held up my hand for silence. The turmoil hushed. I pointed to where the lifeless form of Gacko lay grotesquely sprawled. There lies Gacko, I said. Then, tapping my chest, here stands Danin Le of the thunder and lightning. Danin Le of the great strength, Danin Le of the green star. Are ye Gacko's men, or Danin Le's men, or is there perhaps among ye one who cares to contest the claim of Danin Le as a laureler? I do not know how the thing would have come out in the end. I was in reality preparing to make a dash for safety with Lil Rin in case my bluff did not work. But at this moment I heard the soft swish of many feet, marching in unhurried military precision, coming through the grill doors behind us. The Tar-Ener! Lil Rin whispered jubilantly, but without turning her head. They have gained entrance to the castle somehow. Uldor did not. I don't know how long we stood there, not daring to show our own happy surprise, and not wanting to destroy the dramatic picture by abandoning our pose. But, at last, we knew that the clansmen had all filed onto the platform to stand behind us in formidable array. Then, furtively at first, and finally with a mad rush, the Epsom and Ilden clawed the exits, until at last Lil Rin, I, and the Tar-Ener were left alone in the hall. Lil Rin threw herself into my arms, and so ecstatic was our embrace that Uldor barked a sharp command to the clansmen to about-face, that we, or they, might not be embarrassed. It must have been the latter, because Lil Rin, and I did not even know they were there for a long time. It was a simple enough matter, Uldor explained later, when we questioned him as to how the Tar-Ener had gained the castle. When we found you had been captured, we knew a trap had been set. So we pretended to abandon you and flee. We sped back to the border of the desert, and our dogs were so fast we knew no pursuit could have kept up with us. So, instead of returning toward Bolin, we cut deeper into the desert below Gacarlu. Then, following the great Gacalon Canal, we dashed straight north and flashed through the city itself to the very walls of the castle before any opposition developed. There was commotion inside. The walls were unguarded. We scaled them by shooting a line over a parapet with a spring gun, and then hauling up a stouter rope. We heard the roar of Dane and Liz guns. A few Gacalunian we met were fleeing in terror. We ran through the corridors toward the sound of the guns. The rest you know. At this juncture, a slave entered and bowed low. Master, he said, there is a great crowd shouting acclaim to Danin Le and Er Lil Rin. They have sent emissaries to beg that you will appear before them. Lil Rin looked at me shrewdly. You can't show yourself this time in these tatters, Danin Le, she protested, or they'll expect you to look that way always. Whatever shall we do? There's undoubtedly a store of clothing here somewhere, I suggested, but it might take us hours to find. Then I got an inspiration. Hey, wait a moment. I've got myself a swell idea. Danin Le first appeared on this planet among the Tar-Ener. Right, his bride is a Miara of the Tar-Ener. It is fitting that the garb of the Tar Ener shall be the official dress at the court of the new Alaruller and the Alaruller of Mars. It was nothing but a flash thought, suggesting itself to me as a quick solution of a bothersome problem. But Lilrin gave me a startled look, as did Eldor. "The Tar Ener descendants of kings," she murmured in a tone of awe. "And so, my Danenlay, you have fulfilled yet another prophecy, or their garb shall be the garb of kings. It is a phrase in the ancient tradition, over the interpretation of which our wise men have puzzled for many generations. But come, we have no time to waste. Quick, Eldora, give us clothing." And so a few moments later, garbed exactly alike in the simple costume of the clansmen, Lilrin and I step forth from the great triangular gate in the base of the castle, to be greeted by a mighty roar of acclaim from the united populace of the Carlu and the men of the Ilmen fleet, which now was tied up at the quay. "Hail to Danenlay and Lilrin, Alaruller and Alaruller of the northern cities!" roared the crowd. "Allah and Allah of Gacarlu, Miaruller and Miaruller of the Tar Ener!" And then, in front of them all, Lilrin kissed me. "So much as I would like to return to my native planet, I feel that my duty lies here. No Martian, I am sure, could lead anything but a miserable existence on Earth, where gravity is so much greater, and Lilrin says she wouldn't let me go without her. Besides," she points out shrewdly, "the tradition says nothing at all about the second Danen flying off in the void of space on a foolish trip to the Green Star, and besides, the people wouldn't stand for it. As for that Martian who had betrayed Lilrin and me to the overlord of Gacarluel, one must realize that spies are ever to be found when conditions of war obtain. Perhaps, on the other hand, it had been a clansman of the Tar Ener, jealous of my position and determined to bring me down, by means fair or foul, from a pedestal not of my own making. But whoever that informer may be, I shall seek him out. Some day, I hope during my lifetime, someone will rediscover the secrets that died with old Dr. Brandish, who built the first successful spaceship, and then promptly went insane when I flashed off to Mars in it. Some day I shall find time to study the mechanism of that ship and transmit the specifications to Earth by radio, so that, perhaps, a delegation from the old home planet may visit us here and see what Lilrin and I have accomplished as the rulers of half a world. I wish I knew what the other half, below the great equatorial desert, is like. In fact, if I can ever convince Lilrin that I am not secretly planning a return to Earth, for, being a woman, she doesn't like the way the first Dane skipped out and left his bride, I'm going to have the water pumped out of the old spaceship and whisk across the desert in it to have a look at that other hemisphere." The end.
The End of The Prince of Mars Returns by Philip Francis Nolan. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Story Hack Podcast. Make sure to check out Sidearm and Sorcery Volume 3. So when average people are swallowed up in supernatural trouble, sometimes they have to stand against the darkness by themselves. These are their stories. Included in this volume are 12 new stories of regular people facing the worst the paranormal world has to offer. These heroes may not have powers, but they refuse to be powerless. You can find more information about Sidearm and Sorcery Volume 3 at storyhack.com.